Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a couple of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with President Obama's trip today to Wisconsin and discuss the bellwether political battle shaping up in that state, where Governor Walker, who is facing a recall, has declared that a win for him would deliver a devastating blow to Obama's re-election campaign. John Nichols, The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent, joins us from Madison, Wisconsin. He is the author of the new book, just out, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. Then, with tensions rising over assassinations by Iranian operatives and a cutoff of Iranian oil to European customers, which has driven up the price of oil today to $120 a barrel, as well as President Ahmadinejad's announcement of Iran's rapid progress in nuclear enrichment, we will discuss the lack of enthusiasm within the U.S. military for a war with Iran many of the top brass believe would be messy, bloody, unpredictable, and ultimately inconclusive. A Quaker and former conscientious objector turned war correspondent, David Wood, joins us. He has an article at the Huffington Post, Iran's nuclear threat brings no U.S. enthusiasm for a military strike. And joining us now from Wisconsin is John Nichols, who is The Nation magazine's Washington correspondent and the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He and Robert McChesney co-authored It's the Media Stupid and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells Wars, Spins Elections and Destroys Democracies. His latest book, just out, is Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Nichols.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And today in your state, President Obama visited Milwaukee Master Lock and Key Factory, and the governor, Scott Walker, the very controversial governor, had said that he couldn't make the tour of the factory with the president because he had stomach flu. However, he did show up at the airport to greet the president, where he gave him a Milwaukee Brewers baseball jersey that read Obama with the number one on it. So what's going on with the governor? Is he trying to infect the president, give him stomach flu?
I know. Really, the question that everyone should be asking is whether the president brought along hand sanitizer. because it was a bizarre, bizarre moment, because everyone was waiting to see Scott Walker spent the better part of the day with Barack Obama. Walker is a militant critic of Obama. In fact, just last Friday at the Conservative Political Action Conference in Washington, D.C., Walker gave a keynote speech and literally ripped the president on economic issues, on style, on politics. And so the assumption was that this would be a rather tense meeting. Instead, Walker announced this morning that he wouldn't be doing most of the day with Obama, wouldn't be going to the factory because he had stomach flu. Everyone said, well, all right, that's understandable. You're sick, you should stay home. But instead, he says, but I will come to the airport, get the photo opportunity, the picture of the governor with the president, give him this jersey, then I'll take off. As the day went on, Governor Walker also felt healthy enough issue a series of press releases claiming credit for the things that President Obama spoke about at the event. So there was a good deal of skepticism about whether Governor Walker was really sick or whether he was looking at a very difficult circumstance. They were going to be standing in an industrial setting with Obama talking about the national renewal of manufacturing. You know, so, you know, I have to tell you, I think it's very minimal, but some progress toward economic recovery. And Walker had stood next to him facing the reality that under Walker, Wisconsin has not had a manufacturing renewal. And in fact, over the last 6 months, has been the one state in the country that each month has posted job losses. He has a very, very dire economic record. And so my sense is that it was a political choice, that he decided at the last minute that he wanted to have his picture with a popular Democratic president, especially when he's facing a recall election. He did not want to risk the analysis of his policies and what they've done to Wisconsin.
Well, I guess it could have been worse, though. He could have wagged his finger at the president like the governor of Arizona did.
But he was never going to do that. He... The reason that Walker, who's been so harshly critical of Obama when he isn't near Obama and when he isn't in Wisconsin, is because Walker faces a very, very difficult recall election. The voters of Wisconsin have petitioned for his removal. More than a million of them signed those petitions, saying they want a new election to get rid of this governor. And so he's in a very, very vulnerable place, very bad place politically. He polls very poorly among Democrats and independents who lean Democratic. And so the reason he wanted to be around Obama today, or at least get that photograph, is to sort of soften his image as, you know, this kind of draconian figure that Democrats really hate. And so that it was a political games all around, and I think quite transparent, which has tended to be the story of the last year in Wisconsin.
Well, we certainly want to get to that, John, and your new book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street, a book that was released yesterday, Valentine's Day. And the president carried Wisconsin by 14 percentage points in 2008. But then 2 years later, there was something of a Republican sweep led by Governor Scott Walker, capturing nearly every statewide office. Then he overstepped his bounds and created a tremendous backlash with his union busting. And now he's facing this recall election later in the spring or summer, where you mentioned a million signatures, which is way below the threshold necessary. I'm sorry, way above the threshold. But the point here is that Walker himself has already framed this recall election at the CPAC meeting on Friday that where he gave a speech. He's basically saying, Walker's saying to the faithful, the Republican faithful, that if he wins, it could deliver a devastating blow to Obama in his re-election campaign. So is there a flip side to that as well?
Well, there is. I mean, the fact of the matter is that the whole of the United States, not just Wisconsin, but this country is really at a pivotal moment politically. And I think if we can be realistic about it, way beyond politics, going deep into the economics and the basic structures of the country, Americans are going to have to make some fundamental choices over the next year. And those choices really are between an austerity agenda pushed by members of Congress on the Republican side, as well as many Republican governors, and frankly, to be honest, also quite a few Democrats. And that austerity agenda says that we've had some hard times. Maybe even if the economy is getting a little bit better, we still have a lot of debt, a lot of deficits, a lot of challenges. And that as a result, the sacrifices that would be necessary to balance budgets really have to rest on the shoulders of working-class families, working-class communities, and the great mass of Americans. That austerity agenda is a lie. It is basically rooted in the fantasy that everybody is responsible for the difficult economic times that we're in. It's not the case. What we really need is an accountability agenda that holds those political figures, and particularly those corporate figures who profited so mightily over the last decade, to account and say they have to pay their fair share. They have to return at least some measure of the largesse that they absconded with through ridiculous tax breaks, through bank bailouts, and a host of other policies that favored the 1%. And because we're at a point where we're really looking at such choices, when things go one way or the other, it will have meaning. If Wisconsin does not recall and remove Scott Walker, who's made himself the point person in attacks on labor rights, but also on public education, public services, in many ways, the whole of the commons, those elements of our lives that we share together and work together on. Walker's really been quite brutal in his assaults on these things. If he wins, there will be a message that goes out from Wisconsin, and the message will be that Republican governors, and again, I think many Democrats, can and should go even more aggressively in the direction of that austerity agenda. By the same token, if Walker is defeated by this popular movement that has risen up first in the streets and then with a renegade politics of recall and aggressive challenges to the sitting governor, not at the next election, but at the demand of the people. If that politics wins, then the message from Wisconsin will be a very different one. It will say that that accountability agenda has real potential and that it can shift the electoral direction of a state and maybe a nation very, very quickly. So there's big deal stuff at stake. And for better or worse, Wisconsin has become the center of this debate. The Wall Street Journal, not exactly a liberal operation, suggests that the Wisconsin recall election is the second most important political test of 2012, second only to the presidential race. And I frankly think that there are a lot of Republicans and even a good many Democrats who agree with that.
Again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent and the associate editor of the Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. He's the author of a brand new book just out, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. So given what you've just told us, John, how high the stakes are for both the Republicans and for President Obama and the Democrats, then I imagine money's going to pour in, right, on both sides. We already know that Governor Walker he has super PACs already, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. Look, Governor Walker is raising money at this point at a rate of roughly $5 million a month. That's $5 million a month. To put that in perspective, we thought it was an incredibly big deal when a Las Vegas billionaire gave Newt Gingrich $5 million early on in this process to try and renew his candidacy. That was front page news. It was a really big deal. So the governor's raising that every month, and it's coming not from Wisconsinites. It's coming from outside the state. 61% of his donations in his most recent filing came from Texas, Florida, New York, K Street in Washington, and other places outside Wisconsin. So he's bringing in a great deal of money. It's going to be essentially the political equivalent of nuclear war in Wisconsin once this recall gets going. Walker will have immense amounts of money, and those who challenge him are likely to have at least a reasonable amount of money. It won't be as much, but organized labor has recognized that this really is a life and death battle. And I think you will see, substantial spending there. At the end of the day, though, Walker won't be beaten by money. The only way that Governor Walker will be defeated is if this mass movement that's risen up, a movement that literally put hundreds of thousands of people in the streets a year ago this week, and that then has raised this million signatures for the recall. If that movement takes its people power, aims it in the right direction, there were 30,000 volunteers actively involved in the recall petitioning, for instance. That's a powerful counter to money power. And I think one of the most frustrating things, and it's something I write about in the book, is the lie that many Americans tell themselves that the money really does have to overwhelm everything. Money's very, very powerful. It's dramatically too powerful in our politics. But Saul Alinsky, the guy that Newt Gingrich always picks on, was actually right. There is one thing that, in American history at least, and hopefully still today, can beat amalgamated money power, and that is amalgamated people power. When people are organized, when they get out and do things, they can accomplish great ends. And so the Wisconsin fight, in addition to being a great test on these labor issues, a great test on the austerity issue, is also going to be a real test on whether people power can challenge money power.
And John Nichols, in terms of this titanic battle that's coming up in the spring or the summer to recall Scott Walker, he's clearly the face on the Republican side, but on the recall side, do they have a face? Do they need a face? You say they need people power, but presumably when you recall a governor, you're going to replace him with someone.
That's right. And it's a challenge that we have in our politics. Our politics is so personality-driven that we frequently lose sight of the issues and think, oh, you've got to have a person. I think that in Wisconsin, it's very important that the recall process, which grew out of a non-electoral street-based activist demonstration and protest politics, be careful about too deeply into that personality zone, the issue has to be in the forefront. It has to be front and center. And that means the recall election has to be about Scott Walker's attack on working people, on their communities, their schools. That's got to be what it's about. But, of course, you have to have somebody who can carry that message. And so on the Democratic side, there will be a candidate, and that candidate will be a prominent player from Democratic politics in Wisconsin, more likely than not. And at this point, I can't tell you who it will be because we haven't even scheduled the recall election yet. That's still in a process of review of the signatures and challenges by the governor. He's trying to delay things as long as he can. He's a subject of a John Doe investigation into criminal corruption related to his 2010 campaign. Not the governor. I should say the governor's campaign is the subject of that. We don't know if the governor personally is going to end up being drawn in, but I mean that's a big deal. So he's had a lot of negative headlines recently, and he'd like to delay the process for as long as he can. Ultimately, though, once the review of the signatures is complete and the election is scheduled, then there'll be a timeline. It's at that point that it will be critical for Democrats to stand up. They can have a primary, and my sense is that it is very possible that people will see a very prominent Democrat, perhaps a current or former member of Congress or the Senate, stepping in, perhaps another figure. You know, certainly there are plenty of state legislators who are already talking about running, some county officials. You know, consider your mid-level political players, and I think that any number of them probably could carry the message, but I don't rule out the prospect that someone as prominent as a former Senator Russ Feingold might yet be talked into running, although Feingold's been very resistant. He has not leapt to the race, but you know, I think this is such an intense moment and such a remarkable political opening, if you will, a chance to really do something very different than what we've seen in other states and in most of our national politics, and a chance to fuse this politics of protest, this real challenging of the austerity agenda, with a more traditional electoral politics that I hope that the Democrats recognize this and seize on it and run in the right way. It shouldn't be a very traditional campaign. Nothing about what's happened in Wisconsin over the last year has followed standard current political patterns. It's been much more exciting, much more vibrant, and I think that a boring, predictable politics would be a bad idea. Democrats could still lose this race. It is entirely possible that even with all this people power, you could lose. But I think that the way to win is unquestionably to color outside the lines, to have sort of an outside-the-boundaries campaign. I think Feingold might be somebody who could do that, but there are also several other candidates who could probably fill the bill.
Again, I'm speaking with John Nichols, who is the Nation Magazine's Washington correspondent and associate editor of Capital Times, a daily newspaper in Madison. He's the author of the brand new book, Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. So let's get into the book. And just to finish up on Walker, you mentioned his campaign's in trouble. A couple of his key aides have been interviewed by the FBI. I don't know where indictments stand, but
there have been some felony charges. And these have been to people very close to the governor. So that's a real issue.
And then, but the issue just came up is that the this paltry $26 billion for the people with distressed mortgages and who have been victims of bank fraud. The money that was agreed with all the state's attorney generals is, of course, a drop in the bucket compared to the, $800 billion or so in terms of real losses. But apparently, Wisconsin's share of that $26 billion, most of which goes to California and Florida, the governor says it's going to go into balancing the budget. It's not going to go to the victims of the massive Wall Street subprime fraud.
Isn't that mind-blowing? I mean, it's, you know, when that happened just a few days ago, I was sort of, in a jaw-dropped moment. I don't get that way very much about politics, but here you have a guy who's made such a big deal, like many of these Republican governors, about the fact that he's going to do really tough things to balance budgets. And once you get some balance, then, you know, you're going to have opportunity to have growth and to move forward. Well, Walker has done a lot of tough things. He's backed unions, public schools, public services, and gotten most of his way on a number of issues. And yet, the economy is actually worse than it was when he started by a number of measures. And now he has a new budget deficit. And he's fundamentally dishonest about this. A year ago, when he had $137 million budget deficit, he said that was such a crisis that he needed to take away collective bargaining rights, undermine the civil service, and in a whole number of other ways, change the state of Wisconsin. And that's what caused all the demonstrations, the hundreds of thousands of people in the street last year. This year, he's got $143 million shortfall, a little bit more than what he had last year. And he says, oh, it's not a big deal. I will take care of it by shifting some money around. And then to make the choice of shifting money from a federal fund set up to, or a federally organized fund set up to relieve the mortgage stress on low-income people and their neighborhoods, he takes the money out of that rather than dialing back some of the dramatic tax cuts that he's given to wealthy people and corporations. It's almost, if you wanted to see the embodiment of what Occupy Wall Street is about, why Occupy Wall Street was needed, why it's become such a force in America, it's because it's shined the light of day on policies like this, approaches like this. Not just bad policy, but literally an immoral policy that robs from the poor and gives to the rich. It does every once in a while cause even so cynical a reporter as myself to be a bit shocked.
Well, just in closing, John Nichols, what struck me immediately was the numbers of people and how often they came out and how persistent they were. And these were ordinary folks. These weren't, you know, your regular demonstrators, you know, who show up in handfuls usually. This was a vast cross-section of people. And I'm wondering whether it could be translated into a national uprising, to use your title. I mean, there's so many great stories in your book. I also, because it's my namesake, I love the story of Ian's Pizza's house right next to the Capitol, where they delivered thousands of pizzas to the demonstrations on behalf of callers from all 50 states, but also from as far away as Antarctica and from Egypt, in the middle of Egypt. revolution.
You're exactly right.
That gives you great heart.
The day I've talked to the Ian's people, I write about it a little bit in the book. The day that they got the call from the union representing the Suez Canal workers, saying, you know, we want to lay our credit card down and send some pizzas to the Capitol. I mean, that was just, I don't see how you can't be, almost a little giddy. Because we've talked for an awfully long time, those of us, people like you, I hope people like me, about the need for international solidarity, the need to look across borders and make connections with people who may not have exactly the same experiences as we do, but who share the same desires and also face many of the same challenges. And when Wisconsinites took a cue from Egyptians and went to their square and occupied it just as Egyptians had right before the Wisconsin struggle, and then to have the Egyptians come back and indicate their support, it was, you know, you're coming full circle there in some ways. And the Ian's Pizza story is a wondrous one. It shows how passionately people around the country wanted to support what was going on in Wisconsin. But there's a thousand stories like that, stories of, you know, rockers like Tom Morello, you know, trudging through the snow to get to the demonstrations in Wisconsin, and of people from around Wisconsin just giving themselves to this movement. People who never have been involved in anything political before suddenly becoming intensely and constantly political. And you know, I've been in places around the world that have been in transformational moments before. South Africa in the early 1990s. Middle East at many key points, both in Palestine and in other countries of that region, and Israel itself. And so I've seen intense moments and intensely political times. What happened in Wisconsin in February and March, and to many extents what continues to happen to this day, is one of those moments where everybody's talking about what's going on and where huge numbers of people are highly engaged and won't let go, won't stop. And that's where change comes from. Change doesn't ever come from a president. It never comes from somebody with a lot of money, at least not change for the better. Change for the better comes from the bottom up, and it comes when great masses of people decide that they're going to become highly engaged and stay engaged until they get what they want. It's happening in Wisconsin. I think you're seeing some of it happen in states like Ohio. There are real movements building up in Arizona to challenge anti-labor and anti-immigrant laws down there. And, you know, what we do need to do is start to weave all these movements together, to connect them, to tell them that they should remain rooted in their place. They don't have to give up their passion for the core issues that they're fighting on. But as they move out of that place, you know, they ought to connect with people in other states, both for the strength that their allies in other places can give, but also for the lessons that they can teach. If we do this right, I think we can have a new politics of protest that is less about elections and more about holding the elected to account. If we get there, I think we can nationalize things, and I think we can also begin to talk about movements that matter and that don't always get diverted into, you know, electing the lesser of two evils, and remain in the streets, remain pressing power for the better of many good.
Well, John Nichols, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
It's been a great pleasure, Ian, and I wish you luck with challenges that lay ahead, because this station and your show are really a vital part of a national conversation, a national dialogue that keeps these issues in the forefront. So I very much appreciate you.
Well, thank you again, John Nichols, who's the Nation magazine Washington correspondent. He's associate editor of the Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. And he and Robert McChesney co-authored It's the Media, Stupid, and Tragedy and Farce, How the American Media Sells War, Spins Elections, and Destroys Democracy. His latest book just out is Uprising, How Wisconsin Renewed the Politics of Protest from Madison to Wall Street. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking to a Quaker and a conscientious objector who became a war correspondent.
Christians both drinking blood, and they'll pray for the destruction of all hatred, more often just those with hate for us. 'Cause it hurts when you discover one's worse and one's better to suffer or cause others to. And you can live by your conscience. Now guilt is a concept.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Wood, who has been a staff correspondent for Time Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, Newhouse News Service, and the Baltimore Sun. A birthright Quaker and former conscientious objector, he covers military issues, foreign affairs, and combat operations, and has been a Pulitzer Prize finalist for national reporting. He has accompanied U.S. military units through Desert Storm and the Persian Gulf tanker war in 4 trips to Iraq and 5 trips to Afghanistan, and has an article at the Huffington Post, Iran's Nuclear Threat Brings No U.S. Enthusiasm for a Military Strike. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Wood.
Thank you, Ian.
And today, of course, there's been a considerable amount of news coming out of Iran with Ahmadinejad, the president, visiting a nuclear facility. Now they're up to 6,000 updated new generation of centrifuges. In Thailand, a group of Iranians were captured, one of whom an explosive device went off in a home. 2 escaped. A third was wounded. He tried to flag down a a taxi cab covered in blood. The cab driver refused to pick him up, so this Iranian pulled out a grenade and tossed it at the cab. It bounced back and blew up his leg. He's in captivity. And the Iranian government also announced that they're going to preemptively cut off oil supplies to a number of European countries because of the European Union's embargo that begins in July. They'll obviously turn off the taps earlier. At least that's what they're saying they're going to do. So into this mix comes your lead article in the Huffington Post, David Wood, basically saying that the top brass in the U.S. military have no stomach for a war with Iran.
Well, I thought it was interesting as I cast around and talked to a lot of people in the Defense Department and in the field military. Look, the American military has been at war for 10 years. It's been a long, hard slog. The people who are in positions of power now inside the military, almost all of them have a lot of combat experience, which makes them, I think, a little more cautious about venturing into something like a war with Iran than perhaps defense officials might have been a generation ago.
And how much has what happened in Iraq affected this attitude? How much is it responsible for this attitude in the sense that not only the U.S. military got burned in Iraq, the entire country did, and it was a huge setback for the United States around the world. And, of course, strategically, it's a massive failure because all it's done is, and, well, arguably, Iran is the winner of the Iraq war. So,
I don't get that sense at all. Quite the opposite. I mean, the sense you get from the military here is that they were sent to Iraq to do a very difficult job. They got it done. Iraq is now in a better place, they say, than it was before. And, I mean, they don't feel like it was a disaster or a fiasco or a defeat at all. No, that's not what's going on here. What's going on here, I think, is a keener, more personal appreciation of the difficulties and costs and unintended consequences of war.
Well, then, would that include the unintended consequences, even though people like Brent Scowcroft warned that this would happen, that invading Iraq would only make Iran stronger?
No, again, you know, the folks that I'm talking to are professional military officers and enlisted people, and they don't make those kinds of decisions. When they're asked to go do something, they go do it, and they take pride in what they do. So it's not a question of whether they think Iraq was a failure or not, or whether they feel they were forewarned or anything like that. I think what's going on here is that this generation of military leaders has a deeper appreciation of, you know, how things can go wrong, of the consequences that can happen when you use military force. And let's face it, you know, the military option, going to war with Iran, would be a very, very difficult, costly, and difficult to predict how it would turn out. Although I think there's no doubt that the U.S. would win, but the question, as always, is at what cost?
Well, in your article at the Huffington Post, David Wood, Iran nuclear threat brings no U.S. enthusiasm for a military strike, where you quote a number of senior military officials right at the top of the U.S. military. You also quote a former Defense Department official who asked not to be identified. He offered a quote from Winston Churchill, apropos what you just said: "Never, never, never believe any war will be smooth and easy, or that anyone who embarks on the strange voyage can measure the tides and hurricanes he will encounter. The statesman who yields to war fever must realize that once the signal is given, he is no longer the master of policy, but the slave of unforeseeable and uncontrollable events."
I think what's going on here, Ian, is that again, this generation of military leaders are saying to the politicians and policymakers, if you ask us to go into Iran in a conflict, of course we will do that and we will win. But before we get put in that position, please consider that it's unpredictable, that the cost would be very high, that there are ways that Iran can escalate a conflict horizontally, if you will. That is, by not counterattacking against the United States directly, but by, for example, attacking some of the Gulf states, by using terrorism in any number of ways that would be costly for the U.S. to react to.
Again, I'm speaking with David Wood, who has been a staff correspondent at Time Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, Newhouse News Service, and the Baltimore Sun. He's a birthright Quaker and a former conscientious objector, yet covers military issues, foreign affairs, and combat operations, and has been a Pulitzer Prize finalist for national reporting. He's accompanied U.S. military units through Desert Storm and the Persian Gulf Tanker War in 4 trips to Iraq and 5 trips to Afghanistan, and has an article at the Huffington Post, "Iran Nuclear Threat Brings No U.S. Enthusiasm for a Military Strike." Given Iran's propensity, if you will, for asymmetrical warfare, in the sense that they have surrogates like Hezbollah in Lebanon, and they also, of course, have a considerable border with Afghanistan and Iraq, there's some concern being expressed, even by the Secretary of Defense himself in a recent interview with the Washington Post, that the Pentagon is quite concerned that Israel will strike Iran sometime in the spring. Now, if that were so, or to be so, wouldn't U.S. troops in Afghanistan be vulnerable to Iranian asymmetrical warfare? And wouldn't the U.S. embassy in the Green Zone in Iraq, along with Basra, wouldn't the personnel inside the Green Zone be vulnerable as well?
Well, I think given Iran's propensity to engage in terrorism, and you'll remember just last fall, there was a plot uncovered here in Washington to assassinate the Saudi Arabian ambassador. I think if there were a war with Iran, Americans everywhere would do well to be on their guard. Clearly, Iran has a global reach of terrorism and can mount attacks pretty much anywhere, as you indicated at the top of the program. So, again, that would be one of the unintended and consequences of going into a conflict with Iran. It would be very unpredictable, and it could be quite messy.
But David Wood, has any of these senior military people that you've spoken to, who clearly are leery of getting into a war with Iran, have they expressed that likely scenario that the U.S. is vulnerable, the troops are vulnerable in Afghanistan to an Iranian asymmetrical warfare?
Well, look, I wouldn't say they were any more. I wouldn't say that they were vulnerable. We're already engaged in a war there. Young Americans are already fighting and dying, as are allies from a number of countries. So it's not that they would suddenly become vulnerable. But again,
well, they'd have a second front, wouldn't they? Because most of the fighting's on the Pakistani side, not on the Iranian side.
No, not so. There's still a lot of fighting going on in Helmand Province in southern Afghanistan, and other areas that border on Iran. But look, here's the thing. I think that the military is being very clear. If ordered, we will go to war with Iran and we will win. That's what they're telling me. At the same time, they're saying, of course, there are costs. Anytime you go to war, there are costs. And I think those are among the concerns that they're raising now.
So you earlier were saying that the U.S. military don't feel that Iraq was a disaster and a complete strategic setback for the United States. How do they feel, those that you've spoken to, and you've done a number of tours, 5 tours in Afghanistan, embedded with the soldiers? There's a new report that's come out that's causing quite a lot of consternation inside the military, suggesting that things are much worse in Afghanistan than the top brass have admitted. Are you aware of that report, David?
Yes, I've read the report, and I wouldn't say it was causing consternation inside the military, except to the extent that many of them don't agree with the conclusions that the author of that report reached. Look, he did the same thing I've done any number of times. You go to Afghanistan, you travel around the country, you collect anecdotes that from which you can draw conclusions about how well the war is going, and the conclusion he drew was that it's not going well. I think a lot of people would agree with that. You know, I talked to a senior general who said, yes, I'm sure he saw what he saw, but the conclusions he drew are different. It's very difficult to judge the trajectory of a war when you're in the middle of it. Certainly there are, and I have seen over the 10 years that I've been covering that conflict, significant progress in terms of bringing security to large parts of the country. At the same time, it's a war, and it's a difficult one, and especially the toll taken by the IEDs or makeshift bombs that are planted by the insurgents is a horrifying toll, and most of the civilian casualties are caused by IEDs laid down by the insurgents. So it's a dirty war and very, very difficult, and a lot of professional military people have said to me that they are making progress. It's very slow, and they're aware that that time is running, time and patience are running out, and it's likely that the U.S. will leave there without the job completely being done.
Well, apropos the IEDs, David Wood, the Congress cut off funds recently to Pakistan because they felt that the Pakistanis weren't being cooperative, since Pakistan is the source, I believe, for almost all of the ammonium nitrate that's used in these simple IEDs that cost, maybe maximum of $10 or even less, but cause enormous damage.
It's a tragic situation. I'm just writing today about the case of a young Marine who was blown up by an IED, among many, many other casualties. This young guy now has lost both legs and one arm. It's a very, very difficult thing to guard against. He, in this case, was walking patrol right behind another Marine who was sweeping the ground for with an IED detector, and he was the second in line, and he stepped on an IED on ground that had just been cleared. So even with the great technology that the United States can bring to the battlefield, they're very difficult to find. They're usually made out of plastic materials. It's a deadly, deadly problem.
And apparently one that we can't get cooperation from our Pakistani allies to stop supplying the main ingredient for these bombs, let alone training and munitions training, which has been alleged that the ISI, the Pakistani intelligence, have provided the Taliban.
Yeah, you don't really need much training to plant an IED. I think that's not...
Or to build one.
Not the crux of the problem. But if you've ever been in that part of the world, you can see how difficult it is. Even if Pakistan was really intent on stopping the flow of IEDs into Afghanistan... which I don't think they are. I think you correctly point out they haven't been cooperating. But even if they were, they couldn't stop them. It's just the country is too wild and ungovernable.
So given what you just said, David, how do you think it could be militarily not conquered? That's not the right word, but stabilized, shall we say?
I'm not sure that it can be. Personally, I'm not sure that it can be. You know, there's... I mean, this would take us hours and hours of more discussion to get through, but Afghanistan is a difficult place to govern, and the United States is trying to help build a workable government structure in Afghanistan, and with that structure to be able to bring security and some economic progress to the country. It's a huge job. And as you've no doubt seen, the U.S. has scaled back its goals in Afghanistan. Basically, I think we just want to get out while providing some security to the Afghans. Even that is an enormous, enormous job. The military has tried all kinds of creative ways to try to do that, from training local policemen to empowering local, what we used to call warlords, to provide their own security in their districts. Of course, building the Afghan National Army and Afghan National Police. I spent a lot of time with those folks. Some of them are pretty good. I'm not sure what lies at the end of it.
I was going to say, a lot of them, though, turn their guns on their trainers, don't they? At least it happens a lot.
Not, you know, too many, for sure. But I wouldn't say a lot. It's a constant worry. And as I was recently spent time with some paratroopers with a lot of experience in Afghanistan, and their feeling was, look, anytime you put young people together in a high-stress situation, there are going to be disagreements and sort of cultural clashes. And so they're very intent on minimizing those and teaching their young paratroopers to speak Pashtun, for example. And as you know, almost all the military operations in Afghanistan now are joint operations between Afghans and Americans, or Afghans and Brits and Australians and so forth. So, you know, it's difficult.
Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back in a moment, continuing the conversation with David Wood. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And continuing our conversation is David Wood, being a staff correspondent with Time Magazine, Los Angeles Times, Newhouse News Service, the Baltimore Sun. He's a birthright Quaker, former conscientious objector. He's been covering military issues and foreign affairs and combat operations for a number of years, having gone with the U.S. military into Desert Storm, the Persian Gulf tanker war. He's made 4 tours of Iraq and 5 of Afghanistan. He has an article at the Huffington Post, "Iran Nuclear Threat Brings No U.S. Enthusiasm for a Military Strike." And we're digressing a little bit from Iran into Afghanistan. And the article that I mentioned, which Rolling Stone have put out, I believe it's by a reserve colonel, is it? And
Lieutenant Colonel.
Yeah, you've pretty much told us that it doesn't have a lot of support within the military in terms of its findings. But what is the sense, then, of our future role in a broader sense? I know we've established that the military don't their purview is not grand strategy, but they're there to do the job. They just don't want the leadership, the political leadership, to send them in without some thought about the broader consequences.
Precisely.
But we know that there's a tilt towards Asia now, at least that's what the president has suggested. And that, I think, implies a tilt away from the Middle East. What's the sense there in terms of the military? Would they be happier getting out of the Middle East and being deployed in Darwin, Australia, for example?
Yes, I think they'd be overjoyed. But look, I think they recognize that the United States is going to be deeply involved in the Middle East for a long time, that we have significant interests there, political and economic and cultural, and that they're going to be asked to do a lot of things in the Middle East. Asia is equally an interesting part of the world. The United States has a great strategic interest there, and I think different parts of the military are going to be deeply involved in Asia. I think the U.S. military role in Asia will be largely a naval and air. The U.S. military role in the Middle East, I think, will be more ground troops, special forces, advisors, and that kind of thing. But, you know, my sense is that the military is tired. They've been at war for a long time. It's been very, very difficult. It's been a long, grinding haul for the families. There are a lot of wounded. It's been costly in terms of wearing out equipment and vehicles and weapons and so forth. I think people are sort of like a break.
So you've touched on something that I understand the military families feel, and that is that the burden of these wars of the last couple of decades since we've had a so-called all-volunteer army and you don't have the citizen's connection as you did when there was a draft, has led to a condition where, one, we have undeclared wars, which, of course, Ross Perot is making a lot of hay out on the campaign trail, and two, it seems that the military families are the ones that bear the burden because the public at large is not engaged, and in many ways you could argue that the Bush administration in Iraq deliberately sanitized those wars by getting an agreement out of the press not to show dead American soldiers or dead Iraqi children, for example, and not to see the bodies come home. They didn't pay for the war. They kept it off the books, etc. So has this led to a sort of societal disconnect from the American people and their own military?
That's a big question. First, let me correct something you said. The press didn't go along with being told not to show pictures of the dead and wounded. We fought bitterly against that and finally won permission from the Bush administration to cover the return of military remains to Dover Air Force Base here on the East Coast.
Well, that's a welcome connection.
But in a larger sense, I think you're right that there has been a disconnect between military families and civilian America, and that's one of the costs of having built a professional army. The military families that I know are extremely proud of their service and their sacrifice. They're proud of what the United States has accomplished in Iraq and Afghanistan. They pay close attention to what's going on. And one of the good things about this situation is that unlike during the Vietnam era, everybody I talk to, civilian and military, supports the military folks involved in this. There's no public turning against the military people. I think the public has turned against the war, and there's been a lot of disagreement and debate about whether we should have gone into Afghanistan, whether we should have gone into Iraq and stayed, and so on and so forth. But the support for the troops has been steady and very, very impressive, and I think the military is gratified that the public supports them.
So in terms of the sanitization of war, if you will, the first Gulf War was when we first saw smart bombs in action in those Pentagon briefings that had something of the feel of a video game. But now it's because of the new drone technology. It's evolved considerably since then. And you have people sitting in air-conditioned trailers in outside of Las Vegas or various parts of the United States deciding whether to shoot a target below that they can see on television. And this has, as you well know, David, has led to a great deal of disquiet in amongst our civilian population here about this kind of threshold into a kind of sanitized war that the drone warfare represents. And it has all kinds of complications vis-a-vis how far up the chain of command it goes, etc. Obviously, there's a lot of moral objections to it. And some people that I speak to and get letters from are deeply outraged by what's happening. How do the military feel about this drift away from, you know, the more hand-to-hand type of combat towards this kind of armchair combat?
Well, another big question, Ian. I really appreciate these questions. They're really, really good ones, and it's good to get them discussed. First of all, I can't speak for the military. I don't know what they're all thinking, and it's, you know, it's a big, diverse organization, and lots of divergent opinions about things. I will say this, that in my experience, much of war has already been conducted remotely. That is, I have sat in a B-52 bomber and a B-1 bomber, for that matter, 5 miles up, where munitions are being released, and boy, you can't see much from that height. And we rely on, or they rely, the air crews rely on digital technology and smart bombs to get the munitions on the place where they mean to go. It doesn't mean they know what's there. They can deliver munitions precisely on a point. They don't always know what's there, like I say. So So that's going on, which means that the drift away from manned bombers to unmanned bombers is, you know, I don't see a great deal of difference. It's still somebody looking at, you know, a piece of intelligence. In my experience, again, the military goes to great lengths to try to ascertain what the target is. For example, watching a house in Afghanistan, and I've seen them do this for hours and hours and hours and days and days and days, building an intelligence picture of who's going in and out, what they're doing, and who they are, and so forth. And when they're absolutely certain, then they go ahead and authorize a strike. Whether it's carried out by a manned bomber 5 miles up or a drone seems to me not to make a great deal of difference. We need to be very, very concerned about all aspects of warfare, not just attacks by drones, but attacks by ground troops on compounds in Afghanistan, which I've also seen happen. You know, war is destructive. People get killed. Mistakes are made. I certainly don't think war is any either cleaner or more dirty than it was 100 or 500 years ago.
Well, in closing, David Wood, I'm sure our audience are curious about the notion that a birthright Quaker and former conscientious objector has spent so much of his journalistic career on the front, in the battlefield, with soldiers, seeing death and destruction firsthand. How do you explain that paradox?
Well, I think it's important that we all understand what goes on when war happens. And with other people in the military, you can't go through those experiences and come away thinking that was a good thing to do. You know, war is terrible. It's destructive. It's unpredictable. And a lot of professional military people would prefer that we not have to get into it. They do it because they find honor in serving their country and being professionals. That's fine. I find honor in understanding what they do and telling their story so that the rest of us who don't go to war can really have a good feel for what it's like, what happens out there, and, you know, I hope, think harder about the alternatives, especially before we go to war. You know, I spent a lot of time in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq writing about what the consequences would be and talking to people who'd been through other wars and giving them voice to talk about how destructive it was going to be, how unpredictable it was going to be, about the human cost of engaging in war. And, you know, there was very little debate about that before we launched into that war. So, again, I'm still convinced that war is a bad thing. I see individual acts of immense courage and self-sacrifice and honor, but by and large, it's just a bad thing and we ought not to do it. And that's why I write about it.
Well, David Wood, I thank you so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Wood, who's been a staff correspondent successively for Time Magazine, the Los Angeles Times, Newhouse News Service, and the Baltimore Sun. He's a birthright Quaker and a former conscientious objector who covers military issues, foreign affairs, and combat operations, and has been a Pulitzer Prize finalist for national reporting. He has accompanied U.S. military units through Desert Storm and the Persian Gulf tanker war, and also in four trips to Iraq and five tours of Afghanistan, and has an article at the Huffington Post, "Iran Nuclear Threat Brings No U.S. Enthusiasm for a Military Strike." This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.